This is a true story.
The podcast you're about to hear was recorded in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Eden something, Minnesota, I wish.
And New York.
In 2017.
At the request of the survivors, the names have been changed.
Out of respect for the dead, the rest of it has been told exactly as it occurred.
Welcome to the first official Better Call Fargo edition of the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the fring to my swango and the cash to my tango, it's Dan.
Hey, I kind of wish I was swango because she's really tall, but it's okay. It's not an insult.
Well, you got to be the cool villain instead of the hip chick. So, wait, I just made myself a chick. Look at that. There you go. What a great way to start this grand experiment of ours, this podcast merger, which I guess we're at the very least semi-officially calling our Better Call Fargo podcast.
Works for me.
Yeah, I might even call it that in the feed. I haven't figured out how to do that yet, but maybe I'll just change the title. Who cares? Why not? Well, we did figure with two of the most impressive shows on TV to talk about, you know, let's combine them into one. And you know what? Let's not waste any time because we got stuff to talk about here. So let's kick things off with our thoughts on the latest episode, which is more like a week ago at this point, of Better Call Saul. Now, the title of that episode was simply Witness. And it was again directed by Vince Gilligan, and this time it was written by Thomas Schnauz, I believe that's how he would pronounce his name, who cares, who has written several Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul episodes. Now we all know that we had the appearance of a certain favorite villain from Breaking Bad was going to be the big deal coming into this episode. I'd really rather start off talking about the whole Jimmy and Chuck storyline and how that's unfolding. I mean, I think that's really been the driving force of the season so far for me. I mean, I've really been enjoying it. How have you been liking it so far?
Yeah, I have no complaints about that storyline.
I mean, with Chuck, I mean, I think he's proven that not just that he may be as devious, quite frankly, as his brother has ever been, but I love the fact that Chuck, who has always presented himself as like this, the honest, the almost pious one, quite frankly, he not only played Jimmy like he's like the world's biggest mark or something, but he's doing it like he's playing chess, if that makes any sense, because he's had to orchestrate this plan with like all these multiple moves ahead of time.
Yeah, he definitely is. He pulled it off pretty well this week.
So a question that occurs to me, you know, now we've seen various schemes go into effect by Jimmy over the past couple seasons, but I think pretty much they always tend to have consequences that Jimmy didn't foresee, shall we say. So they're always kind of flawed to a certain degree, and they don't quite work out the way he wanted. You know, right, even including like this whole Mesa Verde scheme, which has now put him in hot water thanks to Chuck and his, let's call it his dogged pursuit of the truth, even though I don't think that's what it's really about. But this plan of Chuck's, the recording, making sure Ernesto had heard it, having a private investigator on the premises, clearly not really for protection, but as an objective witness. But it's this whole layered and detailed scheme, you know, like what we're saying, you know, with many moving parts. Now, I mean, we don't know how this is all going to turn out because it's way too soon to get to, you know, Saul Goodman to happen. But I'm wondering, is Chuck actually better at this than Jimmy is maybe?
Because, you know, I think they're both probably equally good, but it seems like whenever Chuck is involved in anything Jimmy's got going on, I mean, it's just a weakness to Jimmy. So, I mean, he tends to give his brother the benefit of the doubt, or at least try to, or just like kind of like, you know, partially wishes he could reason with him. So I think that kind of like limits his like natural abilities just when he's dealing with Chuck.
Yeah, I think that this is the one situation, type of situation where Jimmy kind of falls prey to emotion and sentimentality, which Chuck clearly doesn't have. It's also interesting if you think about it, in a weird way, there's a certain bizarre similarity between Chuck and Mike, of all people, because he's proven to be far more methodical about what he's doing, where I think Jimmy tends to be more prone to give in to impulse, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, he's very spontaneous and whatever, late.
It's been a long week, and it's a long, long weekend. Yeah. Well, I think what's kind of, one of the things that's kind of sad, and there's a lot of sadness here, that the whole thing feels tragic because, for any number of reasons. But Chuck seemed to believe that this was going to work more to just believing that Jimmy's just a big sneak, that he was going to slip into his home in the middle of the night or something. But like I was saying, it's emotion. It's emotion that drives Jimmy to show up. You know, his rage, his broken heart over his brother, quite frankly, which clearly still doesn't mean anything to Chuck. And I think despite Chuck's talk of, like, the law and doing what's right as an officer of the court and whatever other nonsense he's spouting to Howard and whoever, it seems to me that he's acting out of pure bruised ego. I think that's where he's going here, if that makes any sense. I mean, I still believe Chuck is still a truly fascinating character, and you know there's so much more to his issues with Jimmy, which they hint at again when Jimmy made that comment about Chuck's wife, Rebecca, you know? But I think we might have said this last week, or however long ago it was now, that they really have seemed to point Chuck to being more of a true villain now than he had been in the first two seasons, right?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, that definitely seems to be the reaction that people are having towards him, you know. But it's just, the reaction people are having, I'd say it's come more of a gut reaction, you know. They want to like Jimmy, and it's just like, the stuff we had before, you know. You want to like Walt, so you get pissy with Skyler for like wanting him to fucking come home. It's the kind of same thing. So, you know, yeah, Chuck's being kind of a D-bag, but he's not exactly wrong.
I think with Chuck, where Chuck's flaw is, on the face of it, he's not wrong as far as what's happened to him. Because Jimmy did screw him over. Jimmy did embarrass him tremendously, you know, in public, and, you know, and called into question his abilities. So I get all that. But the fact that what Chuck is doing, because, you know, it is his brother, and he's doing it he's more vindictive about it.
He's completely in denial about that too. I mean, you know, he genuinely thinks he's doing like the right thing, and he's just doing whatever he can to justify what he's doing, because he just can't admit that he's actually, I mean, like, you know, in one way behaving like Jimmy, and another way just like, you know, being a bastard and going out to get revenge.
Right, absolutely. Whereas, you know, the comparison, I think I've heard this before. I can't remember where I heard it last time, but very recently, the Walter Skyler thing. Whereas at least Skyler's actions to me never came from a place of vindictive vengefulness. I mean, you know, I understood her motivation. I mean, we understand Chuck's motivations up to a point, but not, he takes it way too far. I mean, he's going.
Other than fucking Ted was a little bit vindictive. Other than that.
Yes. Well, you kind of put that in, you know, hand in hand with what Walt had done, you know, there. I forgot about the IFT. I forgot. I guess there was a little bit of vindictiveness at that point. That's true. But it certainly set up an interesting dynamic where it's very much the classic, you know, brother against brother situation. And I believe both brothers have a certain amount of denial. Like what you were just saying about Chuck, absolutely. I mean, he's self-denial, or he's bordering on self-delusional, quite frankly. But so is Jimmy, because it's kind of like he always wants to believe the best about Chuck, and Chuck always wants to believe the worst about Jimmy. I think that's probably a more succinct way to put it, I guess. But, you know, it's great drama to watch, and watching, you know, Michael McKean continues to impress me more and more, because this is just a very different role for him than what I've been used to over the last several decades watching him act. So it's made it an interesting thing to see compared to when season one first started, and Chuck seemed very weak. He seemed, you know, all we were doing was wondering, is his disease for real or not? And whether he was practically a convalescent or not. And now he's kind of become a much more powerful character, despite his foibles and with the tin foil everywhere and all that stuff.
Have you seen the, well, I always have to bring it up, but have you seen the Star Trek Voyager episode with Michael McKean playing like the like weird like clown thing?
I'm pretty sure I haven't.
Oh, yeah. It's not the greatest episode, but I think you'll definitely appreciate his just fucking like awesome performance there, because he fucking totally kicked ass there. And like playing like, you just wouldn't believe the range that his character plays. It's pretty sweet. So he definitely, you know, he's better on Saul, of course. But
right. I'll look forward to checking that out one of these days in the coming years. So we should check that off as the first Star Trek reference in our podcast today. It could be the drinking game every time you make a Trek reference. It's either that or Curse, and can't decide which is the better one. But, you know, speaking of villains, you know, I'd like to flip. Let's flip over to the Mike storyline. You know, which was I thought was really nice that it actually included Jimmy this week. You know, in order to help him stake out everyone, and I know your favorite chicken joint, other than maybe one that's in your area, Los Pollos Serranos. But let's talk a little bit just how they built up to that, because I felt like for a little sliver or chunk of the show, they kind of went almost full tilt noir with Mike when he was continuing to pursue that gas cap.
Yeah.
And then when you move beyond the noir stuff, which was, I think, the total vibe, you know, earlier, then we got what I thought was a visually stunning nod to one of your favorite movies, if not your, actually, I think it is your favorite. Is it your favorite movie or second favorite movie?
It's just below Vertigo, but it's really, really close.
Well, we should probably explain what you're talking about, since I didn't see the title.
Lawrence of Arabia, the excellent David Lean film.
Yes, it's, you know, and I'm always happy that I did have the opportunity to see that on a gigantic movie screen, and because that's one of those few movies, when you see it on a big screen, you realize, oh, this movie makes so much more sense on a big screen than on a little TV somewhere.
Hopefully someday I can do that. I've seen Vertigo on a big screen, but I haven't seen Lawrence yet.
Just keep your eyes open for a re-release in a Revival House or something, hopefully in your area sometime, or
Revival House or like some barn that they put a big projector in.
Yeah, I guess there's that. Or if I find out about it playing in New York, like in coming months, I'll tell you, hey, hop a flight. Yeah, you're going to do that. But it's that moment, I think it's when Mike gets out of the car and he's up on the horizon line. That was like the whole Lawrence of Arabia thing. I thought that was just gorgeous. Just wow.
Oh yeah, that was sweet. I mean, that's a really nice shot. It must be fun to line up stuff like that.
Now, what's interesting is, you know, last week or in the last episode, I should probably stop saying weeks because of when we're recording this. You know, we had a very extended sequence with Mike and the whole process of, you know, with the gas cap and the tracker and everything, which was mostly, a lot of that was without any dialogue. And then this week we again had Mike in pursuit, and then we get to the stuff with Jimmy later on. Now, I personally really enjoy that. I find it very compelling, and for TV especially, because basically it's movie making on a TV show. And, you know, the two movies we just mentioned, Arabia and especially Vertigo, actually, are known for these, you know, extended scenes or sequences that are not with dialogue, that are just, and you're just taking it all in. And I personally think they're really doing a good job with that. I'm enjoying that they're breaking the rules of standard TV by doing that, personally.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, they're letting their actors work without actually needing them to use dialogue. And the actors can definitely pull it off. I mean, obviously we know that Jonathan Banks can act without saying anything, or he can say something and just completely devastate us with the way he speaks. And of course, Mr. Odenkirk is really awesome like that. And we got to see, you know, him in this episode as well, acting with very limited dialogue and just show that, like, you know exactly what's going on, what their character is going through. It's very tense. You don't have to have dialogue every time, or it doesn't have to be like, super, for something like this, it doesn't have to be like super awesome, like thick dialogue, like in The Wire, like, the legendary, like, fuck scene. I mean, like, they're just saying fuck, but you know exactly, like, the tone and inflection behind every one of those, and it's not just, like, standard, like, pat dialogue like we've seen everything, so I'm more than fine with them just doing this right. Kind of thing.
I mean, if there was anything that could conceivably work against these sequences last week, and especially this week, it's because, unlike most things that you'd be watching, TV or maybe even film, but TV, we're already anticipating where it's leading, because we are aware of Gus Fring. We know Gus Fring from Breaking Bad, and we know he's showing up here. So, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because I just think they're just building up the anticipation by doing this. Building up, I mean, it's tension more on the low end, because we know, we don't expect anything crazy to happen that fast, but we're waiting for these huge meteors of characters just to finally collide with each other that we've been waiting for years in some senses. And getting back, since you mentioned Odenkirk, yeah, because we got that extended sequence with Mike last week with Ascension of the Dialogue, and they kind of flipped the script this week, and we almost get the same thing with Jimmy. But here's the thing I wonder if some folks might have caught on to, if they're paying attention, and why I felt it worked so well. I thought it was done as a direct parallel to the Mike sequence, but showing how they are so much the opposite. Because Jimmy, he's not remotely cool, calm, or collected. He's not terribly discreet. and then you think about how Mike was. It's like, Mike is about as cool as they come, quite frankly. And the fact, I mean, how awesome. We have that entire sequence of Jimmy where, like I said, everything from almost hitting the soda machine and, he sticks out like a sore thumb. I don't even think he eats his food, quite frankly. And it ends up with him literally with his head in a trash can. Which, that shouldn't be lost on anyone. That says more than what was happening in the scene, which I thought was really funny. That's how he and Gus Fring actually meet each other. So we did get to Gus Fring here. I love that we're not just waiting for him to show up. We see him well ahead of time. We see that he's blurry in the background, but we recognize that pale yellow shirt, and we're just waiting.
That was some really sweet, I don't know, what's that called? Focus pulling? I'm not sure exactly what they did there, but that was really awesome.
Yeah, it was a great artistic choice, because anyone who's at least seen Breaking Bad, and I would say it's the vast majority of the people who watch the show, I would think, we know what's coming. We're waiting, and now we're just waiting how they're going to interact, what's it going to be, and it can't be too much because it's way too soon. And I was never very clear in Breaking Bad just how aware Saul was of Gus and vice versa. I mean, obviously Gus knew all about Saul because Gus knows all. I wasn't really clear that Saul Goodman was too knowledgeable about Gus Fring, because I think initially it always seemed like he thought Mike was his guy, his PI on hire, when it turned out,
right,
it wasn't really quite the case.
Yeah.
But just getting to see Giancarlo Esposito again, and, he doesn't look much different, He looks pretty much the same. I mean, if Aaron Paul looked as much the same as Esposito did, we would want Jesse to come back soon. But the great part was not the interaction between him. I mean, the stuff with him and Jimmy is great, of course, especially the trash can and the watch and all the other stuff. It's that moment a little bit later when we see Gus outside the restaurant, when you realize, oh, he knows. He knows something's going on, which I guess is what leads to that gas cap with the phone on it later on, right? I think that's later on in the episode.
Yeah.
It has to be.
Now, do you think that that Mike did that on purpose, like specifically to pick Jimmy as like somebody who's kind of inept and would like, you know, be a very obvious spy, just to kind of like, you know, set up a meet or something like that? Or do you think that him, like, you know, playing his cards at this point would have been really stupid? Because it definitely seems like, you know, Mike would know that Jimmy would be just a completely, like, useless, like, the most obvious, you know, person eavesdropping ever.
Well, I thought about that. I thought about whether Mike was using Jimmy not so much for actual surveillance, but kind of to force the hand. The only reason I'm going to say maybe not is because I don't, because Mike still doesn't know who the guy is. He's still not sure of what the situation is. He doesn't know if it's someone who is an employee there, or does someone else show up and take it, or is going to take the bag or whatever. It's still not clear to him. So I think there is something of a risk that Mike takes there. And maybe one could say maybe Mike should have known better. I don't know. I don't think of Mike as being infallible. So, I mean...
No, and he hasn't been sleeping very much over the last couple of days, too. So that probably would affect his judgment a bit.
And let's face it, you know, fast forward several years, Mike gets taken out by Walter White. So clearly, not infallible.
Yeah.
Oh, since we keep mentioning Breaking Bad, which for an episode like this, it seems almost natural... I would say that maybe more, not maybe, definitely, more than seeing Tuco or Hector in the previous two seasons, I thought this episode was the one that gave the most fan service to Breaking Bad fans, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Because, you know, obviously, you know, we got Gus, which we all knew. But we got a couple more. And I got to confess, I don't think I ever considered that we would see the woman that Saul always kind of creepily flirted with as his secretary on Breaking Bad, but We got to meet Francesca in this episode. I didn't see that one coming. That was kind of cool.
Yeah, so presumably she'll be on the show. I mean, probably, you know, the rest of the time, I guess.
I guess she'll have to be. And, you know, kudos to the actress for landing the part again. Well done.
Yeah.
Nice. Christmas cards for Vince Gilligan every year now. You had to love that moment early on when he asks her opinion when he's working on that... the Wexler McGill logo he's painting on the wall, and I believe the exact wording she uses is, "I think you're a little crooked," when she's referring to the letter M. But yeah, they're being really cute there. That was, you know, really nice. But not just Francesca, the fact we actually got a brief glimpse of Victor, who I never expected to see at this stage in the series. So that was kind of interesting too, that Victor was already someone, you know, on the fring payroll, whatever. Although by the time we get to Breaking Bad, obviously Mike has eclipsed Victor. He's a bit higher up on the food chain than Victor. So I'm kind of curious how, if over the course of not probably this season, but future seasons, we see how that plays out. How does Mike not just join, but how does he rise with these people, if that makes any sense?
So just seeing Victor, that kind of opens up that possibility of, like, you know, some kind of cool drama that they'll be able to do in the future in a way we weren't expecting. So that's sweet.
Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to how this is all going to play out. I mean, you've got these two storylines, which I don't see them colliding at any point because they're really too disparate. But, you know, I'm wondering, like, who actually is on the other side of that phone conversation with Mike when he finds the gas cap? I mean, is it actually Gus, or is it, or maybe it's Victor? Maybe it's one of his lieutenants. Who knows? And, you know, on the other side, I get the feeling maybe they showed this in one of the ads. I guess that is Jimmy actually going to represent himself, and is he doing that maybe to keep Kim from getting too further entangled in his whole mess? You know, it's fun stuff here, I think, and we've talked about how much we love the Kim Wexler character, and I did love that she did the "give me a dollar" bit, which actually,
yeah, you know, I laughed out loud.
I mean, it's great because honestly, I've actually seen that done on any number of TV shows and movies over the years, but of course, the first thing we're all thinking of is Saul saying that to Walter and Jesse in Breaking Bad, And I always love that, just like in Breaking Bad, whoever it's said to never seems to have a dollar on them. Like, I guess Saul had a,
Yeah.
I mean, excuse me, Jimmy had
Yeah,
a
that's right.
20.
Yeah, 20 instead of a 5 or 10 or whatever it was on Breaking Bad. Yeah,
Breaking
that
Bad, I think
was.
it was a 5, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
But, I mean, overall, I thought this was, I really liked this episode a lot because they're kind of doing something which is what I loved about Breaking Bad, where they were able to really nicely combine both plot and character in a very strong way in this episode. I mean, there's a lot of plotting going on here. It's, but at least on the Chuck and Jimmy side, and it's a little lighter with the Mike stuff, but we know we're going somewhere with that. But so much character stuff, so much, you know. I mean, even characters like Ernesto get their little moments to shine. And stuff like that. So I very much enjoyed this episode. I was a big fan here.
Yeah, and I totally concur with you. I'm enjoying the way that they're just kind of letting the story just kind of tell itself. And you know, with these this writing team from Breaking Bad on, I mean, they're notorious for they don't really plot stuff out really far ahead of the time. I mean, they kind of have like a general idea of where they want to get, and they just kind of let things happen. So it's kind of nice that they're not like rushing to like get from point A to point B really quick and just kind of like letting things happen, because it is it opens up storytelling possibilities that we really hadn't considered before by doing so. And I just kind of like it. I mean, they're not like just dragging their heels trying to like get another season here or there. They're just trying to tell a good story, doing one episode at a time, just working, 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 and doing a good job, and just kind of letting it happen. And I appreciate that they're just taking the time to do attention to detail and not trying to do cheap thrills and just having a good time setting up cool camera shots.
Well, I think what's also interesting is you're dealing with a show which it, I don't know if we can speak of any other show like that, where we know the final results of these characters from another show. You know, we know what's eventually going to happen to Jimmy McGill. We know what's eventually going to happen to Mike Ehrmantraut. But what's making this fascinating is that doesn't matter. None of that matters. I don't know what's going to happen with Jimmy and Chuck here. I don't know what's going to happen with Jimmy and Kim here. I don't know how Mike is going to get involved with Gus Fring. I don't know what's going to happen with him and Hector. All these things. We know, you know, we know what's going to happen in chapter 30, but I'm lost, not lost, but I have no idea what's going to happen in chapters, you know, 12 through 20. So I'm kind
Yeah.
of it makes me personally, it makes me more excited. And like you're saying, yes, absolutely. Take your time. We're not rushing here because we're not expecting you to get to, you know, the Walter White storyline. That's not what this is about. You know, it's
No.
about, you know, letting this play out. To me, expecting it to go faster, to, you know, speed through this would be like wanting Breaking Bad to jump from season 2 to season 5.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, he, because that's exactly what it seems like to me. Because it would be, you know, Walt is okay. He finds out that he's, you know, he's overcome the cancer, but he really likes being a drug guy anyway. And then he just decides to be, oh, now I'm a big drug kingpin. And then, oh God, I'm dying. And you could have just condensed it that way. I don't want them. They didn't do that on that show. I don't want them to do it on this show. They're taking their time. He's. I don't. It could be 5 seasons before he's Saul Goodman. He might never be Saul Goodman on this show for
Yeah.
all we know. There's no, just because it's called Better Call Saul, it's just because it's telling us where this will end. But I'll use a shitty show as an example, comparatively speaking. It's like Smallville, which had 10 seasons, and we're watching Clark Kent, but he's not actually Superman until like 10 seconds. Lamely done in the finale. Okay, some people actually like it. I shouldn't say it's lame. It's actually okay. But yeah, that's, you know what I mean? So it's
Yeah.
kind of the same thing here. And I'm loving the Jimmy McGill character so much that I don't care about, you know, how long it's taking to do things because it's not like I'm not enjoying, you know, every step of the way. You know, it's the nuances, it's the little details that I think we both of us really appreciate a lot with this show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's like the show is becoming a little bit more like a Mad Men than like a Breaking Bad. So I'm like, you know, I'm fine with that. It's like it's some like, you know, somewhere in between the two. I'm totally fine with that.
I think
take their sweet fucking time. You know, take 5 seasons to, you know, slowly progress. You know, one day in the life of Gene. You know, because we don't know what's going to happen to him after that point. I mean, take all the time they need. Just, you know, show us what's going on here. Keep us wanting more and keep doing a really good fucking job.
I agree. I find it interesting because there's any number of well-regarded, super top-tier shows, I'm using that phrase again, that have at one point or another been accused of that by certain segments of the viewing audience where they get impatient because of the pace of it. They've said it any number of times about Mad Men, especially in the early goings of every season. Hey, but some shows that you might not have seen, but they used to say it about The Sopranos from time to time, because The Sopranos could be like that from here and there. And heck, even The Wire was like that from time to time. And, you know, we're talking about, like, the best shows of all time. I think people, I shouldn't say people, some people, a few people, maybe have been bred more on, or thinking more of shows where they're more network like shows where, okay, we have to get this much story done in this amount of time, and the only time they don't do that is when it's a filler episode. We're not getting filler on the show. They're just taking their time telling a story. I'd rather they take their time than give us like a ridiculous crappy episode, which I don't think they're capable of doing, quite frankly. All right. Is there anything else you wanted to mention about that episode, or should we switch?
No. Just, you know, really good episode. And I enjoy what they did. I found the scene with where Jimmy was, you know, keeping an eye on the dude in Los Pollos to be very, very tense in the way that they kept getting closer and closer on Jimmy's face. It made for a really claustrophobic and really, tense scene to watch.
Yeah, the close-up of his eyes had almost a... They were like borderline Sergio Leone there, but not cool Sergio, but not a cool character.
Yeah, more just like, you know, total klutz character.
It was one of those things where they were really towing the line, because it was borderline slapstick. It never quite got there. Like when he hit the soda machine, if that had been more of a water soda squirting everywhere, whatever, and him trying to put it, that would have been goofy. It was just a slight nudge at it, where, oops, kind of a thing.
They're just like, you know, they're able to be, you know, funny and intense, or just like, you know, the disgusted look on his face when he drinks this like crappy sugar coffee concoction that he made when he was.
And I think some people might have questioned that he would be acting that way, considering he, you know, his life as a con man and stuff. But I think the difference is he's in a situation and he's doing something that he doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't really understand what's happening here. And so he's more inclined to be nervous, as opposed to a situation where he's more in control, which is what all his scams and bars and everything were always like. So that, in that sense, I felt it still worked. I didn't have any issue with it. It certainly made it more entertaining. I didn't picture Jimmy being cool in this situation. Again, he's not Mike. You know, they have to differentiate from them. Okay. I really enjoyed the episode. I'm looking forward to the next one, which is going to be in less than 24 hours.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome. So, I say, let's leave this sun-baked landscape of Better Call Saul for the far chillier environs of Fargo. We finally had the season 3 premiere this week, which was, yay, written and directed by our fave, Noah Hawley. Yay. So it was titled The Law of Vacant Places. Now, probably should take just a moment here. Since every season of Fargo gives us very interesting thematic titles, you know, I did look ahead, and without being, you know, Mr. Spoiler here, it appears that all the titles are going to be based on different types of moves and strategies in the game of bridge. So, just for definition's sake, the law of vacant places, and I'm going to go to a place where I think everyone goes to now for definitions. According to Wikipedia, it's a simple method for estimating the probable location of any particular card in the four hands. It can be used to both aid a decision at the table and to divide the entire suit division probability table. Now, I don't play bridge, and I don't plan to become an expert over the next 10 weeks, you know, but I'll try to look up these definitions and see how the title provides some sort of metaphor or thematic parallel to the episode. So let's get into the episode. Let's talk about that opening. That which I guess was in 1988 Berlin. That I'll admit right off the bat kind of threw me for about a minute or two there. not where I expected any season or any episode of Fargo to begin, quite frankly. Did you enjoy the little departure that we had there?
Oh yeah, I enjoyed being perplexed and just trying to figure out what the hell was going on. I mean, I just figured, you know, maybe this was like something to do with like whatever Crime Syndicate was going to do something this season, but after a while it became, you know, clear that they probably didn't have anything to do with that, and they were just kind of setting us up.
Right. I mean, first of all, let's just distance. We like to, every once in a while, we like to talk about, you know, the way shots look, whatever. For at least the first 5-10 seconds, I was thinking, hey, Noah, you know, I know you just finished Legion, but now you're starting Fargo off like Legion. The whole, the camera moving through the insides of the microphone, which was so odd and bizarre, it felt like we had just put on a new episode of Legion for a second there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was some, like, David Lynch shit there.
Yeah. Oh, right, Lynch, of course. Right. Oh, like when he, coming out of the ear and stuff like that. Right.
Yeah.
Good catch. So in this, the 1988 East Berlin, I guess it's this poor guy, Jacob Ungerleiter, has been mistaken for Yuri Gura. He's about to take the fall for some murder of a woman who shared the same name as his wife, Helga. You know, the whole thing plays very tragicomic, but I also thought they did it deliberately. It was kind of like a wry comment on the joke that starts off every episode and started off our podcast tonight, and hopefully every podcast we do of this nature. The whole, this is a true story at the request of survivors. I thought they were kind of, it was almost a commentary on that, because the whole conversation that the Berlin officer is having is about the nature of truth. And then we go right from that to, this is a true story, which is kind of bullshit.
Yeah.
We know it's kind of bullshit, quite frankly. But
I love the way they transitioned out of that scene too by focusing on that picture.
Right. But also once you watch the entire episode, you realize that everything that happens in that little moment in East Berlin is mirrored in the story that we see taking place in 2010 Minnesota. Because it's all about mistaken identities, you know, unfortunate coincidences that lead to awful consequences. And that's what's happening to this poor schmuck in East Berlin. I mean, they do draw some, there's some fun direct parallels by the fact they do the close-up on the guy's feet, and I think he's wearing, looks like he's wearing slippers, not shoes. And then they kind of have that little gag later in the episode when one of the characters who I haven't introduced yet is about to leave, and he's wearing quote-unquote house shoes instead of regular shoes. I don't know anyone who actually wears house shoes. I don't, is that a thing? I don't know. Is that a rich, is that, maybe that's a rich people thing? I don't know.
Yeah, I definitely you know, in the Russia thing, I like seeing that the actor that was the prisoner, because like I swear I've seen him in like everything in the last year.
Okay, remember it's East Berlin, not Russia. If it was Russia, then this would be the Americans.
Oh, Russia.
Then this would be the Americans. And I also thought that was almost, for a second there, I thought they were actually making a wink at the Americans, too. There's a lot of winks to other things in this episode. The fact that
there's... It was under the control of Russia.
Right.
Close. Yeah.
So, since, unlike Better Call Saul, we're talking about a show where when a new season starts, we're introduced to all new characters. So, let's just dive in here with some of the main ones. We meet, I'm assuming, is it pronounced Stussy? Is that how their last name is pronounced? I'm saying it's Stussy. I hear him and say Stussy, yeah. So I'm going to guess it's
Stussy. It's Stussy.
So we meet the Stussy brothers, Ray and Emmett. For me right now, I'm going to say Ray is the at least somewhat more interesting one. He's the balding parole officer who apparently gave up his birthright for a Corvette. And Emmett, who I guess was the beneficiary of that birthright, which turned out to be some extremely valuable stamps, he's some sort of businessman who's flourished over the years, though we later find out he needed like a $1 million loan a year earlier. One that he's all too ready to pay back, but he finds out what he thought was a loan was actually an investment. So, okay, I'm guessing that these brothers, maybe they're essentially taking the place of like season one's Lester Nygaard and season two's, I guess maybe the Blomquists. I'm not really sure. Is that the closest parallel, I guess, for them right now?
I don't know. I didn't. Yeah, I mean, I suppose.
Well, definitely season one's Nygaard. Season two of Fargo is a little bit harder to nail down because there's so many other players and there's like there's a million bad guys running around here and who is the hero or whatever. Well, actually, the heroes are always the cops, but the Blomquists were kind of like the poor schmucks who get involved in something and at least one of the other turns out to be corrupt as well. Whereas Lester Nygaard turns out to be corrupt. He ends up turning out to be a horrible person himself. I mean, I know it's maybe too soon to judge. It's only one episode. I mean, I did get a kick out of McGregor's twin performances, but right now these two characters didn't quite grab me the way those previous characters did in the first two seasons of Fargo. So, I mean, I'm not going to judge it too harshly because I still enjoyed it. I'm just hoping that as this plot plays out in over subsequent episodes, I don't know, maybe a bit more fear and desperation will make Emmett a lot more compelling to watch because I didn't find Emmett that interesting a character, quite frankly.
Yeah, they didn't use him very much this episode either, right. So I'm sure... You know, in following weeks, they'll make it worth their time.
Oh, they better. But I mean, I did like Ray Stussy, you know, up to a point. Although I think it's clear that the parolee is dating, Nikki Swango, the names, played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who I enjoyed last summer in the show Brain Dead. She looks like she's kind of made out of stronger stuff than he is, and she might even be a little bit smarter than him. I'm not sure. I think. She kind of played that way in this episode, I thought.
Oh, yeah.
I'll say this, though. I love the pissing montage. That might be a first.
Yeah.
And you and I and, you know, at least one or two of our listeners that we talk to on Facebook at times, we've both enjoyed or mocked, depending on the show and the episode, the frequent use of montages in different series on FX. I almost thought this was almost kind of like a wink at those, and was like, "Ah, we're gonna piss on you." Streams of urine everywhere. It was just very—I couldn't believe what I was seeing, but I really enjoyed that quite a bit.
It kind of reminded me of the one from the season one finale of Better Call Saul, the one with him and Marco going around and conning people and stuff. It just kind of had that kind of same vibe to me. I mean, yes. It wasn't quite as like ornate.
Right. Yeah, I could see that. Only with urine. So, and I guess our hero in every season, like we said, is always before this has always been a law officer, you know, from the Salverson family. So this time we get an entirely new person, and her name is Gloria Burgle. By the way, can we just say that no one comes up with better character names for this series than what Noah Hawley comes up with? I mean, we just finished podcasting a couple weeks ago about Legion. And you had characters with names like Sid Barrett and Carrie Loudermilk. And in this episode alone, we got Nikki Swango. We got VM Vargas. We got Maurice LaFay. And then you have a police officer, a chief of police, I guess, Gloria Burgle. I love the fact that a peace officer's name is actually a felonious verb. So I thought that was kind of funny. Which is also kind of odd because if you think what Maurice LaFay is sent to do, that's what he was supposed to do. Burgle. He wasn't supposed to bungle, which led to torture and murder. So I thought it's kind of like Noah Hawley was having a lot of fun with that whole thing there, I thought. I kind of wish they made me, or made at least me personally, or the viewers, I wish I cared more about Grandpa Burgle, because for me, I thought his death kind of didn't really mean anything to me. I don't know how you felt about that. I was kind of like, okay. You know what I mean?
No, I mean, I know we'll end up liking her character. So it's just kind of I don't know. It, you know,
it's almost a MacGuffin. Like, yeah. I don't know if it's quite a well. There's a lot of MacGuffin things that could be seen in this episode. Like, the stamps themselves could be seen as a MacGuffin, I guess. So maybe in a way he acts more as a device or an inciting event. A person acts as an event to get her going.
But, yeah, I'm just for the third time ever, it's like a guy getting killed to like, you know, affect the female character instead of like vice versa.
Yeah, that's true. Interesting. That's right. Although I and then you wonder about the like her odd discovery under the floorboards of those sci-fi novels.
Yeah, I have no idea what the fuck's going on there.
Now, was the implication supposed to be that he was maybe once a sci-fi writer? I mean, why else would you hide them? I didn't understand that.
Yeah.
I also thought it was cute because having a little bit of that little touch of sci-fi in there, I thought maybe that was kind of a wink at the UFO from last season. I wasn't sure. And as much as I knew about this season going into it, because I knew about a lot of the casting, I don't think I remembered that Scoot McNairy was going to be on this.
When I saw him, I remember that I had saw something before, but I completely forgot about that before that point.
Yeah, I was like, oh yeah, because you know I think he's really excellent, although maybe not likable to many people, but who cares? I like the characters who aren't likable. I always find them more interesting on *Halt and Catch Fire*.
He was great in this too. I mean, he completely like became that character.
Right. I mean, I guess. He was, you know, definitely he was good. He was amusing. You know, his whole part of being a screw up that really sets at least some of the issues in motion that are going to happen for the rest of the season. If I'm going to put my critic hat back on, I would also at the same time say he also did kind of feel like, I'm going to say, the stock schmuck that we've seen not just in the last couple seasons of Fargo. And this is I felt about the whole episode as a whole. It was very much like it's just a Coen Brothers movies kind of thing, like the original Fargo as well as other films of theirs. I felt that a lot throughout this episode that it, in a weird way, that it as much as especially last season that they had so many nods to different Coen Brothers movies. This one, for better or for worse, felt more Coen Brothers-esque to me. And the reason why I liked but didn't love that is the thing about a lot of Coen Brothers movies, they don't tend to draw me in emotionally. They become more, detached from them as I watch them. I mean, so they become like, oh, that's kind of fun as a toy to look at, but it doesn't really grab me emotionally. So again, like what you were saying, I hope that changes for me as I watch it. I still, again, I don't want to sound like I hate it. I really liked it a lot, but This first episode didn't grab me the same way the premieres of seasons 1 and 2 did, and that might just be due to expectations as well, but it's just how I'm feeling right now.
Yeah. Well, plus we're pretty wore out too, so maybe we just weren't able to be receptive to what they were doing this week.
We'll see. I mean, yeah. So what do we have moving forward? We got Ray Stussy, who is now been either directly or indirectly involved in 2 murders, because I mean I was initially unsure about his culpability with the Grandpa Burgle's murder, but then I realized nope, that's on him. It's still he'll fry for that just as well. So I'm guessing that's who Gloria is really going to be more in pursuit of. She's going to be more in pursuit of Ray. I don't know how much connection she'll have to the Emmett storyline, and unless those things kind of intertwine, and I guess Emmett is finding himself as an unwilling front for, I guess, some apparently ominous criminal enterprise. And I guess it sounds like they're going to use his business as a means to launder money. It seems like what that's all about.
Yeah.
Oh, although again, an affected performance, so is kind of like, you know, borderline goofy, but I did enjoy David Thewlis in his little part as the VM Vargas part. And I guess we're going to see more of him in the coming episodes. A very different kind of antagonist than what we've seen in the previous couple seasons. And I love that he just has no connect to anything that either Emmett or his lawyer what's his lawyer's name? I did not write down the name.
It's Cy.
Cy, right, Cy. Who, and I love that, it's Michael I think it's Stuhlberg or Sutberg. I really like that actor. He was on Boardwalk Empire, as well as other things. I really enjoy him whenever I see him. See, that's a storyline I'm curious about, because right now I'm like, eh, but I feel it has the potential to become something really great. So that's why I feel like with this show, maybe I need to give it a couple episodes to really see how everything starts meshing together.
Yeah, this kind of felt like the kind of show where, like, you know, this kind of season where, like, maybe you need two episodes to really get into it. You know, because, I mean, you know, even some of the stuff, like, with season two of Fargo, I mean, like, I don't know if we really cared about the Bloomquist right away and, you know, some of the other stuff. And then, you know, and then the more we saw of it, the more, like, relevant and interesting it ended up being. So, you know, I'd like to think that something like that will happen this season for us, too.
Well, I think with season two, you had a bit more of an interesting, inciting event with what happens at the diner and the mystery of that. And we were already dealing with this a potential budding war between crime families. And we were introduced to a variety of very interesting and just like, whoa, you know, kind of characters. And that's probably why that season was so different than the previous one and this one as well. So that's why I always think the season two one kind of really like grabbed me. Like, see, even the season one premiere, it took a good 40, 45 minutes before that really hooked me the way it did for the rest of that series. Because in all honesty, and I loved it once it finished that episode. But for the first good chunk of the premiere of season one, all I was thinking was like, okay, they're kind of going, it's a slight variation on the movie. And then when it got to a certain point, like, oh, it's different than the movie. Oh, it's much more different than the movie. Oh shit. Okay, this is not what I thought. Oh wow, this is much better than I thought it was. Wow, I love this show. Fuck the movie. Again, and one thing that both shows that we talk about on this podcast now have in common, it's a beautifully shot series. I love the fact that we're going to be talking about two shows that are shot as beautifully as any movie that we would go see in the theater. I mean, the cinematography on both these shows is really something. And this episode, again, as Noah Hawley is known for, a lot of inventive and sometimes out there choices for music on the episode. Yeah. I mean, I would go again. I actually like the fact I'm being a little bit critical because I think, because you know, as you know, and some of our more longtime listeners would know, every year that Fargo was on, it was my number one series of the year. So it takes a lot for me to be in any way critical about it, but I'm going to be. The thing with the music is, I think, and everything else, again, like everything else we're talking about, I feel like maybe it needs another episode or two for it to gel better for me, because at some points, it almost felt like it was an impression or even almost a parody of the show or the Coen brothers or an episode of the series for me. So it's, again, it's more, I'm in like good, strong like, but not love, but I'm hoping to find my adoration for everything in subsequent episodes. Because some of the choices, I mean, I enjoyed it, but I kept, it felt like it was almost deliberate. Like, okay, yeah, now you're just seeing that, you just know you can get away with this. Like the music they were playing when Carrie Coon's character, Gloria, Burgle, was like going through the house with the gun and the flashlight. I mean, I enjoyed it, but it was one of those, what's the word I'm looking for? It's a kind of phrase that people sometimes use about Tarantino. I just can't think of the phrase right now. I think you know what I'm talking about, though.
Yeah,
you know, it's a signature thing that Noah Hawley is doing here. I just thought, in a way, you're hitting it a little bit harder than you normally do here. I think
it might be a little, you know, he might be being a little indulgent.
Indulgent,
a lot of music.
That's the word, indulgent. That's the word.
Sweet.
I was thinking of. That's exactly the word I was thinking.
Fuck, I guess we're simpatico.
Nice, and you know, again, love Noah Hawley. Loved Legion, loved the first two seasons of Fargo. Really like this, and I expect to find my love for it as it goes on. I would be surprised otherwise. I'm very saddened otherwise. But at least it shows that he's not, you know, he's not perfect. I am looking forward to seeing more of these characters. Again, it's always tough when you're starting out and you've got to introduce all these new people. And you've got to go back and forth and back and forth. And then while still having time to have character moments so we can decide how much we really like, say, Gloria. I mean, Carrie Coon is doing a double work this right now between this and The Leftovers. So it's kind of going to be fascinating to watch her, you know, within a few days of each other playing two very different characters. What did you think of her in this episode?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't get to see a lot of her, but, you know, it's hard, too, because I'm colored by the work that we've seen her do on The Leftovers, so it's kind of like, it's going to be really hard for me not to, like and sympathize with this character just based on that, which is a little, like, I mean, you know, it is what it is, you know, like, can't do anything about it, but it's just good to see her, you know, doing some stuff. I'm not sure where it's going to go yet. Definitely seems like, you know, a character, you know, it's just, you know, kind of similar to the characters we've seen in the show before, like Gus or Molly or whoever.
Right.
But different, you know, just different in a little bit of way.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to seeing in future episodes, is a way to differentiate her more from whether it be Molly Salverson from season one, or even, quite frankly, the character that Frances McDormand played in Fargo. Because, I mean, take away the pregnancy aspect, you can already see and hear certain aspects of just, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that they all have to put on a certain accent.
Yeah.
And I think, and if I'm not mistaken, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think Carrie Coon's putting on more of an accent with this character than, say, the actress did in season one of Fargo with Molly, who had an accent, but not quite as strong as this one. And that's not a criticism. Wait. People, as you know better than I, based on where you live, you will encounter people who have either weaker or stronger accents. Just, you know, like me in Brooklyn, I know people who have insanely strong Brooklyn accents, and people like me who, not so much.
Yeah, no, that, and it does kind of, you know, that is the kind of thing you see, like, more in a rural Minnesota than, like, the bigger cities. And, you know, while Brainerd and Bemidji and Duluth aren't particular, you know, they're not huge. Well, Duluth is pretty big, but they're definitely bigger than, like, Eden Valley, which is just kind of, like, in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's kind of near, like, a college town, but it's still, you know, it's out in the sticks enough where, like, yeah, it might be a little bit more of, like, the thick exit, you know?
Right. So, The whole way everything goes wrong. Now, that I think that was where I was getting hung up a little bit, because I was thinking about the crimes that have gone wrong in, like, previous seasons of this show and just in general. And this is one of those things where, ooh, we were relying on a lot of really wacky screw ups, you know, one laid after the other, to get to where we got. And I know that, and I don't mind shows needing a certain level of coincidence for things to happen so that characters can come together. I was talking about that with, I was having a TV pilot conversation with someone very recently about a project I'm working on, and I was arguing about the fact that all shows need a certain level of coincidence, you know, like, and I use it as an example since we talked about it in Better Call Saul, like, Breaking Bad relies on some major coincidences for that show to work. I mean, the fact that Walt wants to join, you know, get into the drug biz, and he happens to see this guy who happens to be a former student of his, and all these other things happen. I mean, that these are all, like, coincidences that, you know, were kind of, if you think about it, maybe not all that plausible. This one,
but sense of feeling more contrived than, like, that did.
Yeah,
I'd say.
I mean, everything from, you know, the address and stuff being written on the little slip of paper that blows out the window, and yeah, he has to go, but he has to try to remember, and then he finds, and the fact that he gets the phone book and the place where he ends up going, and he ends up is, you know, Gloria's grandpa or whatever, Grandpa Burgle, who, now, let me get this straight. When she finds him, has he been duct taped to the chair?
Yes.
So, what I found interesting about that, Maurice seems like such an out of it schmuck that I was like, that even that seemed a bit much for him. He seemed like someone who just, like, maybe if he had a gun, he would just, like, pistol whip the guy until he told him the information.
Yeah,
you know, that seemed, you know what I'm saying? That just seemed a bit much for him.
No, yeah, you know, I like the episode, and I think it's going to be a good season, but it definitely, you know, a lot of the stuff felt inorganic.
Yeah, that's probably the thing I'm thinking. It didn't feel as organic as things that, how they went together in the previous seasons. They just relied on just too many things to get to where we needed to get, and we're still not sure about certain things moving on from here.
Yeah, I had a little trouble, and then, you know, I had a little trouble getting past, like, the, you know, like, I know that area. I go to that area and do work sometimes, and those two towns are probably, I don't know, maybe an hour and a half-ish apart. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, like, so for, like, whatever kind of route he's driving there to where, like, you're going to see a sign for this. I mean, like, Eden Prairie is, like, a Twin Cities suburb. This other town's in the middle of nowhere, and it's not large at all. So, I mean, like, you know, where he's going to see a sign for that city. I mean, it's really stretching it. I mean, I know the roads and stuff around there, and I can't even, you know, come close to imagining how that actually works out. So, you know, whatever. It's fiction.
That's, yeah, you sound like, it's like when I complain about things that are shot in New York City, and I realize that's not, there are things that I see and they're on TV shows and movies all the time. Like, that's just not possible. Those things, that's just like the movie Die Hard 3, not possible. It doesn't, you can't get to from there to there throughout that whole movie as fast as they do. It's not physically possible. Trust me. Ask any New Yorker. No. So in a way, it's kind of like you have the rural version of that, so to speak, in your area with this show. But again, I mean, I'm definitely looking forward to how the show unfolds. I'm just not as embracing it as I thought I would be, but still liked it a lot. Still looking forward to it. I still think there's a knowledge that there's still a truckload of characters we haven't even met yet.
I think we're optimistically cautious. I think would be a good way of putting it.
I like the reversal. That's nice. And there's a lot of good here. I mean, I enjoyed all the performances, you know. I mean, you know, the actors are enjoying doing their little. The guys who get to do the guys and gals who get to do the accents, you know, they're having fun with that. I think that's almost part of the fun of watching a show like this, I guess. But it's just I'm looking forward to it, but we'll see how it goes. But right now, I'm kind of like, okay, it didn't. Maybe you spent a little too much time at Legion. I don't know, but let's see. The next couple episodes, how it really starts to work out, and hopefully it will still be able to rank right along with 1 and 2. So we'll see how it goes, right?
Yeah, definitely. I'm interested to see if this, you know, in what ways this connects to previous seasons or the movie, or, you know, or what kind of, like, you know, if they do something like a UFO or a fish tornado this season. I mean, I'm sure they're going to do something. I don't know what the hell they would do, but I'm interested to see whatever kind of goofy thing they end up doing.
Please no fish tornado. Please no fish tornado. So, and this was, this season, this is supposed to be 2010. What year was was the season one? It was 2000.
I think 2007.
Oh, seven. Six or seven. I think it's seven. I think 2007.
And I think and it might have took place over a year or so, because I mean there was like a time jump. Yeah. So there was a couple significant time jump there. So right. It probably took place over a few years, but it definitely was done a couple years, at least 2 or 3 years before this started.
Right. I should look into that. Because that's something I probably should have looked up before we decided to record. We've had all this time.
If only we didn't have a million fucking things to do and we could have rewatched this. And we could rewatch Breaking Bad for Saul, because, you know, it'd be fucking fun as hell to rewatch that.
Yeah, really.
Just don't have time.
Yeah, major apologies to anyone who was waiting for the podcast. It's just one of those rare instances or now in life that both Dan and I have more hectic schedules than certainly than I had anticipated. I didn't realize that my life is suddenly going to become this grinder all of a sudden. So we're probably, not that you people out there really care about this, but probably from this point on, we're probably just going to devote Thursday night to doing like massive podcasting. We'll get together for this one, and then later on we'll get together for the geeky one with our other friends. And so basically I just will never have plans on Thursday nights, which is okay, because I generally don't have plans on Thursday nights.
Yeah.
You know?
Hopefully, you know, we say that now, and our bastard lives might find a way to conspire to make us even busier. So, who knows? But Thursdays, hopefully, will be good enough.
Right, and as far as your impending trip, we'll figure that out when we get to the week.
Yeah,
I don't know if we might have to get a stand-in for you. We'll see how that goes, or not. I don't know. Who cares? We'll figure it out. Okay. With all that said, I think it's safe to say we can wrap this sucker up.
Yep.
So let me begin the wrap up. If you enjoyed this podcast, you'll probably enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. You can like the page and join the conversation about shows like Fargo, like Better Call Saul, and a host of others. You can also find us on iTunes the very same way. We're the Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'd like to call us the Better Call Fargo Podcast, but I still can't figure out how to do that. So, look us up as a Serious TV Drama Podcast there. You can subscribe to our feed as well as rate and review us. And finally, you can follow us on the Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast, where I send out the links and occasionally tweet other things. Although, now things are so busy, that's probably not going to happen either. And that's it. We have recorded like really late on a Sunday before. It's when we did those Game of Thrones ones, right?
Yeah, I think there's been a few other times where we're just, you know, if everything was a clusterfuck and we just squeeze something in before we started our weeks.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. All right, well, I'm glad you were able, considering that you have been on your feet and doing stuff for the last like 18 hours or some insane number like that. I'm still recovering from being burned out from the past week. I'm glad you had the energy to get it together here. And
yeah, well, once we started running our yaps, it definitely got better. There wasn't so much just like,
yes,
I don't remember.
That was my great fear. I mean,
mine too.
I mean, sadly, I probably forgot any number of things that I would have liked to have mentioned. But screw it, you know, people can listen to other podcasts. Yeah. Anyway. Have a good night, Dan, and good night to everyone out there. Thank you.